For God's sake, let us sit upon the ground and tell sad stories of the deaths of kings, how some have been deposed, some slain in war.
Ay me, I see the ruin of my house. The tiger now hath seized the gentle hind. Insulting tyranny begins to jut upon the innocent and aweless throne.
What is a man? Sure he made us with such large discourse, looking before and after, gave us not that capability and godlike reason to fust in us unused.
O my dear father, restoration hang thy medicine on my lips, and let this kiss repair those violent harms that my two sisters have in thy reverence made.
I am a king that find thee, and I know 'tis not the balm, the sceptre and the ball, the sword, the mace, the crown imperial, the throne he sits on, nor the pomp that beats on the high shore of the world.
This is the mighty history of the British Empire, a people living on a tiny island in the North Atlantic Ocean. Built an empire that circled the earth and brought freedom and education to languishing millions. This empire was blessed by Almighty God and one of his best educated teachers, William Shakespeare. Shakespeare has educated some of the greatest leaders of all time, such as Abraham Lincoln and Winston Churchill.
We shall never surrender.
Our troubled world needs a fresh crew of nation-building leaders. Are you ready to step up to the challenge? Welcome to the exciting classroom of Shakespeare's Royal Education with host Dennis Leap.
Well, greetings, everyone. Welcome back to Shakespeare's Royal Education. I know it's been a few weeks since we've taped these, but we have been taping other things in JBL as well. So we're out of school now. The classes are over. It's time to begin summer camp. So there's always something going on here at the college. And then after summer camp, it's not going to be long till we'll be back in classes again. But on our last program, I discussed why William Shakespeare wrote the play, The Tragedy of King Richard II, and I thought I might just review that somewhat, since we've had a little bit of time in between taping. But essentially, he was educating Queen Elizabeth I on how to rule and how to prepare for a ruler to replace her. Now, remember, Queen Elizabeth never married and therefore never produced an heir. And history shows that King Richard was one of the worst kings of the Plantagenets. He certainly did not rule England selflessly, and he was an arrogant and selfish young man. And so William Shakespeare was really teaching the queen about her responsibility as queen, to make sure that she ruled properly herself, but then also that she was to make sure that she choose a new king. And she did choose her cousin. He was also related with the royalty. And King James I of Scotland became King James I of England. And so he did do a lot of good things, and we can thank him for the Bible that we have. You know, the new King James Version was something that he orchestrated. And also, I've done quite a bit of history on King James, and he believed he was in the line of David, and he was like a new Solomon for England. And so that's really interesting. So I also discussed Act 1, Scene 3, which covered the sham knight fight to discover who was the guilty liar. Was it Bolingbroke or was it Mowbray? And this scene shows that when King Richard stopped the fight, he was trying to make sure that the truth was not found out, that it was he who was directly involved with with Mowbray, with the murder of his uncle Thomas. And so one thing we learned about King Richard to this point is that he was very young king. He was very arrogant. He did not want any of his uncles telling him what to do. And there's that whole scene where he says, you know, look, I was born to be king. I was born to rule. You got to do what I say. And that's what he was saying. But every king needs help. Every president needs a team that can help him make decisions. And so, anyway, he was directly involved with Mowbray with the murder of his Uncle Thomas. Bolingbroke knew the truth. His Uncle John of Gaunt, Bolingbroke's father, was a witness to Richard's harsh judgment of his cousin and the accomplice. And so this was the scene where they were out on the, I don't want to say on the sports field, they were getting ready to kill each other. And, John of Gaunt was there. He was watching everything. And we know that what the king did is he stopped the whole thing. He stopped the whole, it was a very legal, it had a lot of legal ramifications to it, and he stopped it. And the reason why he stopped it is he wanted to control the result. He wanted to control the end. And the way the knight fights were set up was, if you died, you were the guilty one. And of course, essentially, the king was the guilty one. He's at the fight. But anyway, if you remember, the king banishes both Bolingbroke for 6 years. He banishes Mowbray for life. And there's a difference there. And the reason he banishes Mowbray for life is he wants to get it out of England that he had anything to do with his uncle's death. And so what better way to do it? Just tell Mowbray, hey, see you later. Don't come back ever. You know, but also in that scene we covered that Richard also demands that two men take an oath not to rise up against him. And so if you want to go back and look at that, that's Act 1, Scene 3, lines 177 to 190. I'm not going to reread those today. But he made them take an oath that they would not rise up against him. Well, as we go into the play, you'll see that the one of them did not keep the oath. And we'll get to that pretty quickly. Now, in this scene, Shakespeare sets us up for Bolingbroke's early return to England. And I just gave it away. He's going to come back really quickly. All right. Now, for today's program, I want to continue with Act 1, Scene 4, beginning on page 26. But before we do that, what I want to highlight just briefly is I want to go back to Act 1, Scene 3 on page 25. And there's a reason I want to do this. I've always do some extra study on this even before and after I do a program. But what I want to highlight here for a minute is something that I did read online. And what I want to highlight is John of Gaunt's fatherly advice to his banished son. And that's from Act 1, Scene 3. That's on page 25. Now, the reason why I want to do this is with the character John of Gaunt, Shakespeare reveals his Bible insight side. And we know that Shakespeare really studied his Bible. We know that he's incorporated the Bible into almost every play he wrote. And so Gaunt's lines on page 25 are similar to Solomon's Book of Proverbs. So let's just go to page 25 really quickly. And let's start at line 275. And it's really very, very interesting. And I have a little subtitle in my own book that I wrote, even for class, is this is Wisdom in Trial. And so certainly it is a trial that here these two cousins, King Richard and Bolingbroke, are cousins. And they grew up pretty much the same age. They grew up together. They were knighted together. And all of a sudden, one is turning on the other. And John Gaunt, with his wisdom, he's trying to get his son to not be so discouraged or despaired by it, but to use it for maybe growth and maybe for growing up. And Gan says, all places that the eye of heaven visits are to a wise man ports and happy havens. Teach thy necessity to reason thus. There is no virtue like necessity. So you know, his son is telling him that he's really upset that he's got to leave England. And John of Gaunt, he's not happy with it either. And John is getting older, and his son is banished for 6 years, and he could die any moment. And he doesn't want to, you know, die without his son there. But he's saying, look, take a different look at this. Be positive. And I think all of us go through trials, and they're never fun. But and sometimes it's better just to accept them, work through them, and then you really do come out happier in the end. And so that's what he's telling his son. Teach your necessity to reason thus. There is no virtue like necessity. And he said, think not the king did banish you, but you the king. He's saying, now that's... I think you could look at that as that's a premonition of what's coming, because that's exactly what he does. He banishes King Richard, in a sense. He says, woe doth the heavier sit where it perceives it's but fairly faintly born. Go, say, I sent thee forth to purchase honor, and not the king exiled thee, or suppose devouring pestilence hangs in our air, and you art flying to a fresher clime. So he's saying, yes, just think about it this way. Yes, well, yeah, I'm being banished to gain honor. You know, and, you know, God does try and test all of us. And, you know, we can fight it. We can be upset about it. We can wish it never happened. But if we just go with it and let God guide us through it, maybe God wants to give us more honor. And so it's really interesting. And he says, not the king exiled thee, or suppose devouring pestilence hangs in our air, and you are flying to a fresher clime. And so he said, okay, we all love England, but maybe there's something you can learn in a fresher clime. And of course, we know he was sent to France. And he said, look what thy soul holds dear, imagine it, to lie the way thou goest, not whence thou comest. And so he's saying, look, open your mind. Maybe you have opportunity in France you didn't know you had. He says, suppose the singing birds, musicians. So he said, when you're over there and it's a new country, you don't know what's happening. And, you know, he said, so when you're there, you know, obviously you're not going to have the same environment that you had in England. He says, so when you hear the birds singing, just pretend they're musicians. You're in a concert. And he says also, the grass wherein thou treadst, thy presence strewed, the flowers, fair ladies, and thy steps no more than a delightful measure or a dance. And so when you're out there, you're walking or you're in the fields, you're doing something out there, he said, just pretend like, well, I'm a dancer. He said, for gnarling sorrow hath less power to bite the man that mocks at it and sets it light. So he said, you know, don't take the punishment. Don't, you know, John of Gaunt knows that the king is not making the right decision. But he said, look, just wait it out. And then Bolingbroke does come back and he gives his resistance. And some of it is really pretty funny. But you can tell this is maybe young man thinking. He said, Bolingbroke says, oh, who can hold a fire in his hand by thinking on the frosty caucus? You know, and so he's saying about the Caucasus Mountains. And he said, okay, if you got fire in your hand, how can you just sit there and think, well, yeah, I really actually have frosty ice from the Caucasus Mountains. He says, okay, that's what you want me to do, Dad. So I don't understand how that works. Or he says, you cloy the hungry edge of appetite. And that the word cloy there means dull. He says, or if you're really, really hungry, can you really dull the fact that you're hungry? And he said, can you dull that hungry edge by bare imagination of a feast? He said, yeah, so you're out in the woods, you're starving to death. Well, just imagine, hey, I'm at a feast. You know, can you do that? And so here the son is saying, okay, Dad, I listened to that part, but here's my rebuttal. I don't agree with what you're telling me. And then he goes on to say, this is kind of funny. This is a guy thing. He says, or wallow naked in December snow by thinking on fantastic summer's heat. And so what's he doing wallowing naked in December anyway? You know, so he, I think that's a little bit of Shakespeare humor. And he may have been a great poet and all that, but he was also a guy. You know, so he said, yeah, so if you're out in the frosty snow and you have no clothes on, you just have to pretend you're in summer and it's warm. And I have spent a lot of time in the winter out in the mountains skiing. And if it's a cold day, it's a cold day. Yeah, that's the way it is. And he goes on to, oh no, the apprehension of the good gives but the greater feeling to the worse. Fell sorrow's tooth does never rankle more than when he bites, but lances not the sore. So God says, come on, my son, I'll bring thee on your way. Had I thy youth and cause, I would not stay. And he's saying, look, take the opportunity. You're getting banished. You know, there could be more fun things out there, is essentially what he's saying. Come on, my son. You know, had I thy youth and cause, I would not stay. And Bolingbroke says, then England's ground farewell, sweet soil adieu, my mother and my nurse that bears me yet. Where I wander, boast I, this I can, though banished yet true-born English man. And so the thing is, he said, even if I go, I will never stop being an Englishman. And that's okay. And we'll finish then Act 1, Scene 3. And I know I read some of this before, but I just thought it was really interesting that we look at it, from a Bible standpoint, from the fact that why did Shakespeare craft this? And I think probably Shakespeare had studied the Book of Proverbs very thoroughly, and it looks to me that Shakespeare really did love the Bible, and he really wanted to encourage people to love and understand the Bible as well. All right, I have a short analysis of this scene. Now we're going to move now into Act 1, Scene 4. And I've even read some of this already last time as well. But I want to give you what SparkNotes says about this scene. And I think it's really interesting. And remember I said last time that when you're reading Shakespeare, sometimes it really is hard to follow. But there are websites out online that if you just go in and look at them, that they can really, really help you see what Shakespeare is getting to. And this is the analysis for this scene. And this is scene, Act 1, Scene 4. I also have the date I marked in my book. It's around the scene took place really around 1398. So that was, you know, quite a while ago. But here's the analysis. This is what SparkNotes says. It says, the scene is short but important. It gives us a look at the contrast between Richard and Bolingbroke, and it also lays the groundwork for Bolingbroke's return later in the play. And so it's essentially this scene, Shakespeare put it there so that we can get a look of Richard as the king and Bolingbroke as the future king. You can get a good look at it that way. And it says, Richard's account of Bolingbroke's departure from London shows us the difference between the ways he and his now banished cousin interact with the people of London. We learn that Bolingbroke paid courtship to the common people, and that he took off his bonnet to an oyster wench, He also bowed to Brace a Drayman. A Drayman is a horse groomer. He cleans up horses. He washes them down. And so these are just common people, and he would spend time with them. That's the way he was. He was different. He would spend time with them. And with Richard, if you remember from last time, he's all buying clothes from Italy. He's all, you know, buying all the high guy stuff. And, you know, he's wanting people to bow to him all the time. He's the king. He's 19 or 20. And, you know, it's like, I'm the government. You're going to do what I say. You know, we also know he was married to a woman, but he also had some friends that, well, they may have been a little gay, not happy gay, just gay. And I think all of you know what I'm talking about there. And this analysis says that he would greet that, let's say, the drayman. He would say, "Thanks, my countrymen, my loving friends." Now, whether Bolingbroke behaves this way out of a cunning sense of politics or of innate humility and good nature, we cannot tell. However, we can be sure that Richard thinks himself far above such behavior. What reverence did he throw away on slaves, he says to his companions, implying that Bolingbroke has wasted his courtesy by squandering it on such inferior people. And so we'll get back to some of this as well. And there's a couple more things that we'll talk about as we go here. So now let's continue now with Act 1, Scene 4. And again, I've read some of this before, but here we have the king, and his cousin Armoral is right there. Now remember that the king and Armoral and Bolingbroke are all cousins. They all have, they're all sons of the fathers of Edward. And they really, it's interesting, they really don't have a lot of love for each other. So essentially what this scene is now, where we are, it says, after Bolingbroke has been this is from SparkNotes again. After Bolingbroke has been banished from England, King Richard returns from Coventry. That's where the mock trial was held, or the mock knight fight. He returns to Coventry to his court, accompanied by two of his friends and allies, the noblemen Bagot and Green. King Richard's cousin, the Duke of Armoral, son of Richard's uncle, the Duke of York, Edmund Langley, has just returned from escorting Bolingbroke out of London. When asked how the two parted, Armoral reports that although Bolingbroke bade him farewell, he himself, meaning Armoral, was cool to Bolingbroke and was glad to see him on his way. And so we're going to read about that just a little bit. But even Bolingbroke, obviously after talking with his father, you know, got kind of control of himself. And here he was still nice to his cousin, who had no nice things to say to him. And so essentially we can see the difference. Richard, you know, is really into fashion. He's into, you know, I think if he were alive today, he'd certainly be on TikTok. He'd certainly be, you know, into crazy music. He probably would like, I don't know, what's her name? Taylor Swift. King Richard would have been a Taylor Swift nut. You know, so anyway, it is kind of interesting there. So after Bolingbroke has been banished, King Richard returns to Coventry. He gets Armoral. He talks to Armoral, and Armoral has just returned from escorting Bolingbroke out of London. And when asked how the two departed, Armoral reports that although Bolingbroke made him farewell, I mean, he bade him farewell. He said, Bolingbroke said, okay, farewell, Armoral. Armoral says he was cool to Bolingbroke and was glad to see him on his way. Glad to get rid of him. But essentially what this shows is that, Armoral is opens the door to see that King Richard didn't have a lot of friendship and love for Bolingbroke as well. So let's go to page 27 now. And essentially, what we'll do is let's now go down to the king here, and that's line 20. And again, this is the spark note is I have a little note from this one that we'll read as well. But notice what the king says. He's talking to Armoral. And then also I want to tell you in the future, I have Armoral is one of the most unique characters in the play. And I do have some spark notes based on that, based on the whole thing about Armoral. He's really, really different guy. But the king says, he's talking to Armoral. And remember, Armoral said, yes, he said farewell to me, but I did not say farewell back to him. And then the king said, he is our cousin, but 'tis doubt when time shall call him home from banishment. And so here, Shakespeare is setting us up that even the king is now thinking, what's going to happen when he comes off banishment? You know, and essentially what Shakespeare is doing, he's setting us up to the fact that he's going to come back anyway. And he's not going to wait to the end of his banishment. And he's concerned that his dad might die when he's gone. And then essentially that is going to happen, by the way. His dad is going to die when he's gone. So he goes on to say, he is our cousin, but 'tis doubt when time shall call him home from banishment. And so here, I think, Richard realizes this is a tough guy. He might not obey me. You know, he may not stay out there 6 summers. And he says, whether our kinsmen come to see his friends, ourself and Bushy Bagot here in green observed his courtship to the common people. So essentially now the king is explaining to Armoral is this guy is really loved by the common people. And Richard is not. That's just the truth. He's not. He's out there buying expensive clothes, you know. He likes to party, you know, with the Italians, and you know, it's just the commoners, you know, essentially are dying, from them, and he's overtaxing the nation. He's hurting the people, and very similar to what is happening on a grand scale in America. You know, we've got some woke people in charge, you know, they're raising taxes, you know, they're causing havoc. People can't make ends meet. People can't buy homes. People are tired of going to the grocery store and not being able to buy enough food that they need. And, this is what was happening all the way back in England as well. And he goes on to say, how he did seem to dive into their hearts, talking about the common people. With humble and familiar courtesy, what reverence he did throw away on slaves. So not only does King Richard have disdain for Bolingbroke, he has disdain for his own people. He's calling them slaves. And he says, wooing poor Creston with the craft of smiles and patient underbearing of his fortune, as 'twere to banish their effects with him, off goes his bonnet to an oyster wrench. A brace of draymen did God speed him well, and had the tribute of a supple knee, with thanks, my countrymen, my loving friends, as were our England in reversion his. And so now this is where King Richard is beginning to think, wow, he thinks England's his. But the point is, he is of legal succession. He is one of the king's grandsons. You know, his father was a son of Edward. And now he does have royal blood. And he is really, can be very much in line for the throne. And so you can see that Richard knows this and understands it. And to me, it's really well crafted by Shakespeare. But again, you have to really study it and kind of pull it apart. to really you know, get it all together. Okay, so then if we go to page 28 now, Green, remember there's Bagot and Green, and the thing is, Green is trying to encourage Richard, and this is what happens. It says, this is the top of page 28, this is line 37, Green says, "Well, he is gone, and with him go these thoughts. Now for the rebels which stand out in Ireland, expedient manage must be made, my liege, ere further leisure yield them further means for their advantage and your highness's loss. And so there was trouble in Ireland. Of course, growing up Irish, I was a troublemaker at times myself. But the Irish, you know, don't want to be ruled by the English. And so one thing about King Richard, he did have to have several wars with the Irish. And Green is saying, look, all right, you did this. You banished Mowbray. You banished, you know, your cousin Bolingbroke. Now, let's focus on something different. Let's focus on getting the rebels under control. He says, "Well, he is gone, and with him go these thoughts. Now for the rebels which stand out in Ireland, expedient manage must be made, my liege, ere further leisure yield them further means for their advantage and your highness lost." And the king says, "We will ourselves in person to this war." So he's saying, okay, I'm going to do this in person now. I'm going to Ireland. And in some ways, after just banishing Bolingbroke and, of course, Mowbray, that's kind of a dumb thing to do, to leave your country, you know, go get a war. And he's also has to gain taxes. He has to gain tax money to have the war. And he says, "And for our coffers with too great a court, and liberal largesse are grown somewhat light, we are enforced to farm our royal realm." Now, how do you like that? How do you like that when he said, okay, we need taxes, we need money, so let's just farm Israel, or let's just farm America, or let's just farm, you know, whatever we can farm. And essentially, what he did is he emptied the treasury. He emptied the English treasury. And he said, "We are enforced to farm our royal realm, the revenue whereof shall furnish us for our affairs in hand. If that comes short, our substitutes at home shall have blank charters." And so essentially, you know, a blank charter is they're not going to have any money. And he says, "Whereto when they shall know what men are rich, they shall subscribe them for large sums of gold and send them after to supply our wants, for we will make for Ireland presently." And so essentially, the blank charters are loans. So he's going to try and get loans to do this. And, you know, it doesn't make any sense what he's doing. Now, Bushy enters and he goes, "Bushy, what news?" And then Bushy is saying, "Wow, old John of Gaunt is grievous sick, my lord, suddenly taken, and hath sent post haste to entreat your majesty to visit him." And the king says, "Where lies he?" And Bushy says, "At Ely House." So he's at his own estate. And so here, you know, Bolingbroke's banished. Gaunt tries to really encourage him to just hang in there. And now he was afraid. He even had talked to the king about, you know, that he was not, he was getting older. And 6 years, if he's gone 6 years, he may not see him, you know, again. And so here John of Gaunt is sick. And the king then says, after he finds out where he is, he says, "Now put it God in the physician's mind to help him to his grave immediately. The lining of his coffer shall make coats to deck our soldiers for these Irish wars. Come, gentlemen, let's go visit him. Pray God we may make haste and come too late." I mean, now, that is arrogant. That is cruelty. This is his uncle. And if you look at John of Gaunt historically, I mean, he was a top leader among all the uncles. He's a very wealthy man, and he literally, John of Gaunt, it's not in the play, you don't see it in the play, but he's the one that actually helped Richard get to the throne. You know, he was his counselor. He was helping Richard. And so, this is really corrupt. He's saying, wow, if he's dead, we're going to steal Gaunt's wealth, and his son is gone. And he said, we're going to make the coats that we need for our soldiers for the Irish Wars. And, you know, then all of the people around the king at that time said, amen. So what great disrespect. I mean, this is a 29-year-old. And, I remember I had a whole host of uncles. My mom was 13th child. My dad was also, there was a lot of, my mom had a lot of brothers and sisters. I even had one uncle. I mean, how old the family was. One of my uncles was killed in Flanders Field. That was a long time ago. And other ones fought in World War I and World War II. And so these are my uncles. And when I could be around them, it was a great learning experience. I really, really loved to be around them. Then I had an Uncle Bud. That was his nickname. It was my dad's older brother. And he would come and see us. And sometimes my father wasn't so pleasant to be around. And sometimes he was somewhat, he's probably just stressed out with all, because he had so many children. And my Uncle Bud, I remember one time, pulled me aside. He said, Dennis, don't worry about this. Everybody loves you. Just be patient with him. So he took me aside and gave me some advice about it. But he didn't like what he would do sometimes to us. And so sadly, though, my uncle got cancer really bad, Uncle Bud. And he couldn't face the fact that he was going to die. So he actually put a shotgun in his mouth and blew his head off, which is sad. That happened. I know that was really shocking to all of us. Uncles are very important. Aunts and uncles, grandparents, they're all very important. And I know even with our family, is my son-in-laws often talk to the other young children of their brothers and their sisters and all that. So it's really, really interesting. Now, we're going to go to Act 2, Scene 1. And this is it's probably one of the best written scenes in the play. And this is enter John of Gaunt. He's sick with the Duke of York. That's his brother. And Gaunt says, he starts out with saying, will the king come that I may breathe my last in wholesome counsel to his unstayed youth? And so Gaunt has been helping him, but he said he's not under control. He's unstayed, or he's uncontrolled. And then his brother, York, says, vex not yourself, nor strive not with your breath, for all in vain comes counsel to his ear. So here's the two uncles, and they know he won't listen. He won't listen as king. And then God says, oh, but they say the tongues of dying men enforce attention like deep harmony, or like beautiful music. And he's saying, look, maybe this is my last chance to really help him. And maybe the voice of a dying man will wake him up. That's what he's saying. And he's also saying it enforced like deep harmony or beautiful music. And we know that that the king was into clothes and he was into music and all that. And so Gaunt is saying, well, maybe my voice will be like beautiful music to him, and he'll listen to it. He says, where words are scarce, they are seldom spent in vain, for they breathe truth that breathe their words in pain. He that no more must say is listen more, than they whom youth and ease have taught to gloss, or to flattery. He said, than they whom youth and ease have taught to flattery. More are men's ends marked than their lives before the setting sun and music at the close, as the last taste of sweets is sweetest last, written remembrance more than things long past. Though Richards my life's counsel would not hear, my death's sad tale may yet undeaf his ear. And so obviously Richard did not like John, meddling in his rule. And York says, no, it is stopped with other flattering sounds, as praises of those tastes the wise are found, lascivious meters to whose venom sound the open ear of youth doth always listen, report of fashions in proud Italy, whose manners still are tardy, apish nation, and that means outmoded nation, limps after in base imitation. Where doth the world thrust forth a vanity? So it be new, there's no respect, how vile. That's not quickly buzzed into his ears. Then all too late comes counsel to be heard, where with will doth mutiny with its regard. Direct not him whose way himself will choose. 'Tis breath thou lackest, and that breath wilt thou lose. So here York is telling his brother, look, it's not going to work. And he says basically what he's really into is lascivious meters. Essentially what he's saying, he spends a lot of time with perverse poems. You know, that's basically what he's saying. He's into porn. And then, of course, he's listening to all this music and he's wants all the fashions from Italy. And so he said, he doesn't think he's going to listen to you. I mean, York says, look, he's not going to listen to you, even though you know as much. And then Gaunt says, methinks I am a prophet new inspired, and thus expiring do foretell of him. His rash fierce blaze of riot cannot last, for violent fires soon burn out themselves. So in some ways, you can see that here's Gaunt. He's really, into the Bible, and he says, look, I'm going to prophesy to him, and I'm going to really show him where he's going. He goes on to say, small shows last long, but sudden storms are short. So what he's saying is, he's so rash, he's so fierce, and he said he can't last living that way. He goes on to say, he tires betimes, that spurs too fast betimes. With eager feeding, food doth choke the feeder. Light vanity insatiate and a cormorant, or like he's like a glutton. And she says, he goes on to say, Shakespeare writes, consuming means some praise upon itself. The royal throne of kings, this separate isle, this earth of majesty, this seat of Mars, this other Eden, demi-paradise, this fortress built by nature for herself, against infection and the hand of war, this happy breed of men, this little world, this precious stone set in the silver sea, which serves it in the office of a wall, or as a moat defensive to a house, against the envy of less happier lands, this blessed plot, this earth, this realm, this England, this nurse, this teeming womb of royal kings, feared by the breed and famous by their birth, renowned for their deeds as far from home, for Christian service and true chivalry, as the sepulchre and stubborn Jewry of the world's ransom, blessed Mary's son, this land of such dear souls, this dear, dear land, dear for her reputations through the world, is now leased out. I die pronouncing it, like to a tenement or a pelting farm, England bound in with a triumphant sea, whose rocky shores beats back the envious siege of watery Neptune, is now bound in with shame, with inky blots and rotten parchment bonds. That England that was wont to conquer others hath made a shameful conquest of itself. Ah, would the scandal vanish with my life? How happy then were my ensuing death. So you have gone here now, probably giving one of the most beautiful poems, in the play. It's talking about England, the kingdom, and of course, I think I've said this before that we really believe what Mr. Armstrong has taught us, and of course, Mr. Armstrong understood prophecy, and we know that the British people are extended from Joseph's son, Ephraim, and of course, the United States is from Joseph's son, Manasseh, and Manasseh was prophesied to be the great single nation in the world, and England was to be identified as a great empire. And of course, I think obviously Shakespeare knew some of this. And look, he's using Gaunt to help see that. And can you imagine Queen Elizabeth, when she hears this play? She saw it, she heard it, and she hears this beautiful poetry talking about her realm. It's essentially what he's talking to her about. And so then the York says, "The king is come, deal mildly with his youth, for young hot coals being raged do rage the more." And so the queen also is there with him. So it's he's got the queen. Richard enters with the queen, Armorall, Bushy, Green, Bagot, Ross, and Willoughby. These are all his friends. And then the queen says, "How fares our noble uncle Lancaster?" And so she's kind of just as much arrogant as her husband is. And the king says, "What comfort, man? How's it with good Gaunt?" With aged Gaunt. So the king is he's not as pleasant. He said, "What comfort, man? How is it with aged Gaunt?" So you can hear it like a kind of like big mouth teenager. Gaunt says, "Oh, how that name befits my composition. Old Gaunt indeed, and Gaunt in being old." So now Shakespeare's playing with the word Gaunt. And if you're Gaunt, you're white. You're white as snow. So he's dying. He said, "With me grief hath a tedious fast, and who abstains from meat that is not Gaunt? For sleeping England long time have I watched. Watching breeds leanness. Leanness is all Gaunt. The pleasure that some fathers feed upon is my strict fast. I mean my children's looks. And their fasting hast thou made me Gaunt. Gaunt am I for the grave, and Gaunt as a grave, whose hollow womb inherits naught but bones." So he's really slapping King Richard, because they're kind of making fun of him. And he said, "Okay, you want to make fun of the word Gaunt? I can outdo you." And he did. The king says, "Can sick men play so nicely with their names?" Gaunt says, "No, misery makes sport to mock itself. Since you dost seek to kill my name in me, I mock my name, great king, to flatter thee." And the king says, "Should dying men flatter with those that live?" No, men living flatter those that die. King says, "Thou art a dying, sayest thou flatterest me?" Then Gaunt says, "Oh no, you diest, though I the sicker be." And he says, you're on your way to death. King says, "I'm in health, I breathe, and see thee ill." And Gaunt says, "Now he that hath made me knows, I see thee ill." And so Gaunt is telling him, essentially, "God has revealed to me how sick you are." And that's what he's saying there. And he says, "Ill in myself to see, and in seeing and in thee seeing ill, thy deathbed is no lesser than thy land, wherein thou liest in reputation sick." So Gaunt is really giving it to him. He said, "Look, Richard, your deathbed is your land, England. You're killing it, and you're dying with it." And he says, "And now, too careless patient as thou art, committest your anointed body to the cure of those physicians that first wounded thee. A thousand flatterers sit with thy crown." And he said, you're surrounded by all these flatterers. And really, Richard, are you thinking about what they want from you? What they want to take from you? You know, that's what he's going after. He says, whose compass is no bigger than thy head, and yet encaged in so small a verge? The waste is no whit lesser than thy land. Oh, had thy grandsire, with a prophet's eye, seen how this son's son should destroy his sons. From forth thy reach he would have laid thy shame, deposing thee before thou wert possessed, which art possessed now to depose thyself. Why, cousin, wert thou regent of the world, it were a shame to let this land be lease. But for thy world enjoying by this land, it is not more than shame to shame it so. Landlord of England art thou now, not king. The state of law is bond slave to the law, and thou. And so John of Gaunt is not afraid to tell him, this is the way it is. The king says, a lunatic, lean-witted fool. So this is what he said. He says, you're a lunatic. He said, you're presuming on an ague's privilege. So he's got a fever, he's saying. Darest with thy frozen admonition make pale our cheek, chasing the royal blood with fury from his native residence. Now by my seat's right, royal majesty, wert thou not brother to great Edward's son, this tongue that runs so roundly in thy head should run thy head from thy unreverent shoulders. So again, now this is a young guy, and he came from such a strong royal family, and he said, look, if it weren't that you were from great Edward's son, which is the same thing he came from, he said, your head should run thy head from thy unreverent shoulders. So he said, if you weren't who you are, I'd cut your head off right now. And so we now have, you know, somewhat of a good idea of Bolingbroke, but now we really get a good idea of Richard and what he's capable of. And, you know, it really is, you know, horrible what really is going on here with the king. And of course his very, very, very educated uncle. And Gaunt says, oh, spare me not my brother Edward's son, for that I was his father Edward's son. That blood already, like the pelican, you hast thou tapped out and drunkenly caroused, my brother Gloucester, plain well-meaning soul. So Gaunt now tells Richard, I know you killed my brother, Thomas. And see, this has been under the undercurrent of the whole play. And he said, it's like, you're like a pelican. If you understand anything about pelicans, I had to get that out. But, you know, the pelicans, the babies, will peck their mothers to get the blood out of their mothers. You know, and so he said, you're like a pelican. You know, you got my brother's blood, and you tapped it out. And I'll just repeat that again. He says, my brother Gloucester, and that's Thomas of Gloucester, plain well-meaning soul, whom fair befall in heaven's amongst happy souls, may be a precedent and a witness good that you respects not spilling Edward's blood. Join with the present sickness that I have, and thy unkindness like a crooked age, to crop at once a too long withered flower. Live in thy shame, but die not shame with thee. These words hereafter thy tormentors be. Convey me to my bed, then to my grave. Love they to live that love and honor have. And so if you think about that, they take Gaunt off the stage at this point. Then the king says, and let them die that age and solace have, for both hast thou, and both become the grave. And so York says, this is the other brother, I do beseech your majesty, impute his words to wayward sickliness and age in him. He loves you on my life and holds you dear, as Harry, Duke of Hereford, were he here. And so he said, look, Gaunt loves you. Bolingbroke loves you. You know, you need to be more positive, and you need to be more respectful. And the king says, right you say true, as Hereford's love, so his, as theirs, so mine, and all be as it is. And then another nobleman comes in, and this is Northumberland. He says, my liege, old Gaunt commands him to your majesty. What says he? Nay, nothing. All is said. His tongue is now a stringless instrument. Words, life, and all, old Lancaster has spent. So, as they're still talking, then Northumberland comes out and tells the king, he's dead. John is dead. John of Gaunt is dead. And then York says, be York the next that must be bankrupt, so though death be poor, it ends a mortal woe. And so York is the next brother that's going to try and help the king. The king says, the ripest fruit falls first, and so doth he. His time is spent, our pilgrimage must be. So much for that. And so that's really, really, really arrogant. And he said, okay, I'm done with this. So much for that. That's all I have to say. And he says, now for our Irish wars. We must supplant those rough, rugged-headed kerns, which live like venom where no venom else, but only they have privilege to live. And for these great affairs to ask some charge toward our assistant due, we do seize to us the plate, coin, revenues, and movables, whereof our uncle Gaunt did stand possessed. And so they have the news of Gaunt's death, and the king says, this is great for us because we're going to take all of his wealth. We're going to take everything down to the, you know, the pots and the pans and, you know, all the gold and silver. We're taking it all. And that's what I have for the Irish wars. That's what he's saying. York says then, how long shall I be patient? How long shall tender duty make me suffer wrong? Not Gloucester's death, nor Hereford's banishment, nor Gaunt's rebukes, nor England's private wrongs, nor the prevention of poor Bolingbroke about his marriage, nor my own disgrace, have ever made me sour my patient cheek or bend one wrinkle of my foreign's face. And so, I mean, there's some really sad things here. And York is a really one of the most, interesting characters in the play. And there is a film of King Richard II. And you can see that York, he's kind of an active guy. He's not as old as Gaunt was, but he's not afraid. He's not afraid to stand up to a young king that is his nephew. So York is going to now actually stand in and take over what Gaunt was doing. Now, that is all the time we have for today's program. On our next podcast, we will continue discussing Richard II, and we'll be moving into Act 3. Now, please write me any comments you may have to comments at kpcg.fm. You can also comment at my Twitter page, and it's titled Shakespeare's Royal Education. Now, you may be able to find a good used Pelican copy of King Richard II at Amazon. I am not recommending ABE books anymore because ABE has found that some of their service people are not charging properly. Now, you can also locate a new Pelican copy priced between $8 or $9 on Amazon. And you may also be able to find a good used copy of David Starkey's Crown and Country at Amazon. So thanks for joining me next time as we advance our royal education.
You've been listening to Shakespeare's Royal Education on Trumpet Radio, 101.3 KPCG, streaming online at kpcg.fm and thetrumpet.com.